Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about the social and interpersonal issues that concern you most. I am your host, Bahabi Lemtombini, relationship coach and divorce mediator, and I'm coming to you live from Harlem, USA. Today's topic is divorce. This topic often sends people running for the hills, but it never hurts to be informed. So I've invited uncontested divorce expert Eric Reimer to the show to help sort out the sometimes complicated path to divorce. We will talk about how the decisions you make now can impact you in a divorce later, what the courts require for you to do in order to get a divorce, and yes, the big question, does she really get half? You are listening to Cuckoo, and this is the bonus track from his album, Unexpected Pleasures. Stick around and enjoy while everyone arrives. I'll be back in just a few moments. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. If you're just joining us, I am your host, Bahabi Lemtombini, and this is Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer. I appreciate that you have chosen to join us today, and I want to give a special welcome to my first-time listeners and to those of you who are studying for your law school finals. I know Dee Reed is listening because she has a family law exam this week, and we are here to help you. So shout out to Dee Reed and to all of you in law school who are in that final stretch for the semester and for the year. All right, so you've heard the song, Kanye West, Gold Digger. I'm going to quote the brother right now because what he says largely makes sense, and this is the first time for me. So here it goes. 18 years. She got one of your kids, got you for 18 years. I know somebody paying child support for one of his kids. His baby mama's car crib is bigger than his. You will see him on TV any given Sunday. Win the Super Bowl and drive off in a Hyundai. She was supposed to buy you short at Tyco with your money. She went to the doctor, got life before your money. Should have got that insured. Geico for your money. You ain't no punk, holla. What? We want prenup. Yeah. oh, yeah, and I bet y'all didn't know I could do that, huh? That's my brand new talent that you hear right there. I'm learning to be a rapper as well. We are full of surprises on this show and full of great information, too. So let's get started. Today we are talking about the dreaded D word. It's dreaded almost as much as death, I think, and it's divorce. I've invited Eric Reimer to the show, and he's an attorney here in New York who specializes in no-fault or uncontested divorces, and we are going to break down some of the issues in divorce that you never knew you never knew. So I'm going to welcome Eric to the show. Eric, your microphone is on. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Good. You know, I'm going to have to ask you to wait for just a second because I'm hearing an echo on my line. And I wanted to find out from the chat room whether they are hearing the echo as well. So, folks in the chat room, can you let me know if you're hearing an echo? All right. They haven't actually heard me yet. That's how long the delay is on the echo. So we're going to see what's going on with this and try to get that fixed so we can get on with the show. All right. No echo from the chat room. Okay, so we're going to keep going, and I'm going to hope that the problem resolves itself, because otherwise, really, I'm not sure how to fix it. But we're just going to keep going. Eric, are you hearing an echo?
I'm not hearing an echo. I was trying to figure out whether the echo was on my side or whether it was on yours. But what I've heard from you so far has been loud and clear, including your fantastic and surprising hip-hop rap right there. Very impressed.
Well,
very impressed,
you.
I say myself.
That is my debut. all right. So I'm going to dive right into the big question. When I ask people about what they know about divorce, she's going to leave us half is, you know, sort of like the one thing that they say they understand about divorce. So tell me, is she going to leave us half?
Well, I'm not going to give you any answer other than it depends, although I can start the conversation off by saying that, as a general matter, we have to clarify first what you mean by will she leave with half. Half of what? Are we talking about the money? Are we talking about child visitation? Are we talking about half of the happiness? You know, it ultimately depends on any divorce, anyone who's coming in on a divorce is going to have to clarify for themselves what it is that they want from half. And I would guess, I'm not a mediator, but I know you are, that some of your job is going to be kind of expanding the pot to a point where both sides can feel like even though, you know, they're leaving with less than they had together, that they can both look at themselves in the mirror at the end of the day and say, well, you know, it didn't quite go as well as we had hoped it would, but at the end of the day, I do have half of, you know, the visitation that, you know, I need to keep me going and keep me happy going forward with my children, or half of the pension that my husband has contributed across his time during which we were married and to which I was entitled. So yes and no, and it depends, and I guess let's take it from there.
Well, sure. You know, I think that some people have the impression that it's half because there are different jurisdictions, of course. Marriage is something that is, or divorce, actually, is something that is determined state by state, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Marriage and divorces are going to be governed by whatever state you currently live in or whatever state you file the action in. Depending on whether you can find a state other than the state you live in which to file your divorce.
So if I understand then, there'll be states, for example, like California, which is a community property state.
Right.
And then New York is what? Is it equitable division?
That's correct.
Okay,
that's
so
correct.
let's break down a little bit for people who are listening what those things mean, because that does
Sure.
really get to the underlying question of, depending on the state that you're in, what happens when it comes down to the money and the
Absolutely.
Just stuff?
All right, when we're talking about the money and the stuff, we can say safely that judges no longer attribute to the husband or the wife any of the gender roles that they used to.
Wow.
And that's to say, yeah, and that's to say that men are allowed to file for sole custody of kids, and it's to say that women, if they're earning income, that income is going to be, you know, imputed to the marriage, just like the income would have been, you know, back, let's say, in a bygone era, where it was, you know, predominantly the men who were the breadwinners. As a general matter, when judges in New York are dividing out property, they are doing so not with an eye towards splitting things 50-50, but with an eye towards splitting things equitably. And equitably takes in lots of kind of fuzzy factors. It can take in how long the two of you have been married, whether the wife during the marriage would have otherwise been working but opted to raise children so that the husband could, you know, work without having to worry about, you know, without his having to worry about what the kids were doing when they were coming home from school day to day. And certainly the longer a couple has been married, and certainly the more out of, let's say, practice the woman is at whatever career she may have previously had prior to the marriage, the more likely it is that a judge is going to say, yeah, you got half. You got half because while your husband was out working, you were a partnership. And whether or not you were actually there in the office, you were earning money for the partnership. And although it doesn't show your name on that paycheck, it's a paycheck that's rightly half yours. A marriage that's shorter, a marriage where, you know, for instance, the woman is an equal contributor, judges are obviously less inclined to say, well, here's, you know, here's a lady, let's say, for the sake of this hypothetical, who, you know, needs the court to equitably distribute money in her favor above and beyond a number that, you know, she would have otherwise been getting, mm-hmm. you know, were she to have just left this marriage without any, you know, any judge intervening on her behalf. So it's not an easy question to answer, although I can safely provide the parameters that the longer you're married and, you know, the less involved in the workforce you are, the more likely it is that you are going to leave with a 50-50 distribution of the assets. And again, I would also offer that to some extent the question precludes me from talking about certain other things that ought to be on minds of some of your listeners, such things, you know, for instance, as the custody and visitation of the kids.
But why don't we get to custody and visitation
sure.
in a little bit?
Sure.
Let me make sure that I'm understanding what you've said so far
sure.
and sort of encapsulate that. So what I'm understanding then is that the rules have changed, or at least the way that the court approaches divorce nowadays has changed from what used to be the convention before, which was
Absolutely.
That, you know, it was expected that you would have a nuclear family where the husband went to work and mom stayed home,
mm-hmm.
kind of a leave it to Beaver kind of situation.
That's right.
For those of you who are in the United States and remember that sitcom. And so that the wife was assumed to be out of the workforce but contributing to the family's financial well-being by staying home and taking care of the home. It was understood that her activity in doing that did contribute to the family's well-being. And so
yeah.
when it came time for a divorce, the fact that she had worked in the home would be recognized in the way that the assets were split. You know, understanding this brings up an interesting and important context that I think that most people don't think about when they're getting ready to get married, because there's so much of romance that's involved and that's well and good and wonderful, but they don't think about how the law views marriage. And what I'm understanding then is that the law views marriage as sort of a business partnership, right?
Well, yes, but without any, I guess I would say yes, but without any cynicism attached to that. You
right.
know, there's an understanding that that even if a, you know, let's I'm going to follow you know gender stereotypes, even though they really don't apply in this day and age. But you know, to the extent that a woman is in the house raising the kids, that is part of the marriage that is integral to the husband earning what monies he's earned. And if the woman is, you know, doing any number of other roles in the classic homemaker, in the homemaker sort of role, that those are roles that are integral to the husband earning the money. And from a business perspective, even though she's not the one taking home that paycheck is rightly 50% his. Yes. Business, from a business perspective, 50-50.
Okay. And so then, even though then she's entitled to 50-50, I'm also coming to understand that there might be other ways of dividing the assets that don't necessarily break down as 50-50 right down the line, penny for penny.
Right. Well, I guess the very first thing to say is that as a general matter, I mean, I can speak for me and my wife, certainly, that, you know, those gender roles are from a pretty bygone era. And, you know, judges assume nowadays, let's even start this with a situation where the wife did stay home to raise the children, that the, you know, wife is not going to be stuck in the house for the rest of her life necessarily, right? If a woman were college educated or if she had a master's degree, that you know, even if she were staying home with the kids subsequent to having received those degrees, that there's nothing necessarily stopping her from getting back in the workforce. And judges are generally inclined to factor into their equitable distribution of assets a fuzziness factor for monies that the woman is going to be earning on her own after the divorce happens and the man and the woman are now living separate and apart. And, you know, the wife is now going to have to at least partially account for her own salary because not all of it is going to be coming from the husband.
So the old ideas about maintenance and alimony and that sort of thing are not necessarily enforced anymore. There is an expectation that a woman who has a degree is eventually going to go back to the workforce and be able to support herself.
That's correct. And it has to be said that this, you know, the lawyers are always inclined to use the word "it depends" because it really does depend. It depends on your state. It depends on the judge. It depends on the impression you're making. But, you know, anyone who is possibly able to be reintegrated into the workforce is going to be understood by a judge to be able to do so, and equitable distribution in the judge's eyes is going to be done from the perspective of, let's get this thing to a 50-50 division of the assets, but let's also keep in mind that this is an educated woman who happens to have been raising the kids for a period of years, but you know, let's say, you know, once it becomes untenable for the marriage to continue, that she go back to the workforce and begin earning a salary on her own. Now, that's not to say that judges can require women. You know, for instance, there's never going to be out of a court a requirement that women go back and start working again. But it should be understood by any woman in a more classic guy is out working, woman is staying home raising the children, that a judge is not simply, especially in a shorter marriage, going to assign for the rest of her life half of the man's earnings because she had started to raise the children.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, you brought up another issue, you know, sort of tangentially, and that has to do with child custody and also with visitation. And a little later on in the show, I want us to get into the details of how couples can negotiate those, what kinds of options they have for visitation and child support. But I wanted to talk a bit about what happens in court and the attitudes of judges nowadays to the issues of child support and child custody. And you had mentioned that judges are no longer apt to simply grant sole custody to the mother, that things have changed. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Sure. Well, again, part and parcel, you know, to some extent, the recognition of equal partnerships, refusal to recognize gender roles in the courts, ends up being a bit of a double-edged sword, let's say, to a woman who's in a more classic setup where the man is out working and the woman is staying at home, in that the man can now rightly and with a straight face come into the court and say, my wife has been a lousy mother to the children, and I don't think that it's in the best interests of these children to stay with her after our divorce, and I want custody. There are men who are doing it because they rightly feel that, and there are men who are doing it because they have attorneys who say that this new perspective on divorce ought to be taken advantage of by the man, and to the extent that the threat, threat, roughly, if they don't mean it, of taking the kids is going to force strategically a wife who very badly wants to be the custodian of her children after the divorce to take what would otherwise be a lesser offer in the name of getting a husband, soon to be ex-husband, to withdraw his petition, his request to have sole custody, joint custody. You know, it'll obviously depend on how the case is presenting itself before the court, but there's no question that men are being coached nowadays by their expensive attorneys to ask for sole custody, even if they don't really want it or intend to have it.
So you're talking about strategic behavior that happens in a litigated divorce context, which can be really unfortunate and really gives rise to the terrors that I think most people feel when the idea of going through a divorce comes up. I mean, there's, of course, the emotionally devastating impact of a relationship of that magnitude ending. But then there's the whole, you know, the fight that can occur when people go through a litigated divorce. And so what I'm hearing is that there's, you talked about a double-edged sword, and I immediately thought about what the goals of feminism have been, which is for equality and equity. And that it's part of feminism that I think a lot of people don't recognize is that it really was about equity, which means that men too now have that women had.
I actually should clarify that and be a little less, I don't know, cynical or lawyerly in that, yes, there are men who want at least equal custody of their children, and in the court's eyes, unless there's reason not to grant it, a judge is generally inclined to say, in light of all of the circumstances, the husband, soon to be ex-husband, is a figure who's been involved in these children's lives since they were born, and it's generally important that children grow up as best as possible in light of the divorce in a circumstance where the mom and the dad are both contributing to their well-being and to their, you know, inculcation of lessons and morality and education and sports and, you know, extracurriculars, and that men are generally entitled to have a very, very involved role with their children. And that can include, you know, up to and including joint custody, and depending on whether, you know, the mom has been proven to be the less equipped parent in the relationship, custody in favor of the father, right?
Right.
Audible?
Right. So, listen, hold on a second. I'm hearing somebody coming through on the line, and I'm not sure what's going on here. So, Eric, this is you, right?
Well, yes, that's me talking right now.
And then there's somebody else who was saying hello.
That I didn't hear it, but I don't doubt that you did.
Okay, let me put this right. This is going to sound very funny. There's somebody else. Is there somebody not Eric who's on the line with me? Okay. My goodness. You know what I'm going to do? I'm sorry to have to break into what we're doing here. The energy is really good, but I'm going to take a break.
Sure.
And we're going to try to fix this, what's going on here on the line, because it sounds like we might have actually a triple echo going on. So I'm going to take a break. Going to play some music here, and you're going to hear from Brandon Ross from his album called Puppet, and it's a song called May As Well Know. So take a listen for a little bit. We're going to try to work on the unfortunate technical issues, but we're not going to let that stop us. In the meanwhile, I see that some people have called in, and I do want to take an opportunity to let you know, if you want to ask questions when we come back, we want you to have the opportunity to do that. So the way you do that is you call into the show, and the number is 818-532-9789. And if you actually want to ask a question on the air, hit the number 1. And that will put a signal up on my switchboard that you want me to put you on to ask a question, and I will do that. But right now we're going to listen to Brandon Ross, and the song is called May As Well Know, from an album called Puppet.
everyone, and I am so glad to be here and to be back with you. You are listening to Untangled Resolutions presentation of The Problem is the Answer, and boy, am I relieved. We had a moment of interruption that you might have heard there. I usually dial in on Skype in order to host the show. Hosting the show is actually a pretty simple matter, usually. I dial into Skype from my computer, and the show goes on. For some reason today, we were having a really long echo on Skype when I was on Skype. I guess none of the rest of you could hear it, but it was long enough that having this conversation was actually kind of a surreal experience. So what I did was that I hung up on Skype and called back in from my cell phone. And so that's one of the wonders of Blog Talk Radio, is that you can actually host the show from your cell phone. And so that's what I'm doing right now. And so I'm, again, your host, Batabi Lemtombeni. I'm a relationship coach and divorce mediator, and I'm broadcasting live from Harlem, USA. I want to let you know about our upcoming show next Sunday, May 8th, and that is Mother's Day. That is a very special show for us. We're going to do a Mother's Day special, and it's devoted entirely to understanding what Mother's Day is all about. But then it's also an opportunity for you to give your appreciation to your mother on the air. And of course, we define mother broadly, so it might be somebody who was a teacher or a mentor, someone who was very special to you, who acted in the sense of a mother. So it doesn't actually have to be your biological mother, but I want you to call in on Sunday and tell me on the air why your mother is so special. I'm also inviting folks to send me email where they tell a story. You can tell me a story about something that your mom did for you when you were growing up that you remember and that stays with you and that you'd like to honor her for. So you can send me email to info@123untangled.com. That's info@123untangled.com. And so you'll have a chance to do more than what we usually do for mothers on Mother's Day. Breakfast in bed, flowers, a card. It's the last year. It's been done. But this is a gift that she's never had before. Tell her you love her over the radio. So I've already received a couple of tributes from people that I will be reading over the air. Please don't miss out on this opportunity. It's free, but it is priceless. All right, so we're coming back to the show. And I'd love to invite those of you who are tuning into the show on the internet to join into the chat room. There's a lot of stuff that's going on in the chat room. I have my chairman of the chat room in there who are hosting from that perspective. They can take your questions there, too. So if you're not sure about calling in and being heard over the air, even though you're anonymous, I don't ask for any names when folks call in. But you can also ask your questions and have a bit of discussion over in the chat room. So be sure to log into the chat room if you'd like to do that. And we have a question from the chat room, actually. I'm going to bring Eric back onto the show. Your mic is back up. Eric, you there?
Hi, both of you. Yes, ma'am.
Awesome. Okay, that's fantastic. We have a question from the chat room, and they were asking, when it comes to child visitation and also to custody, child custody.
Yeah.
Does the court take into account what the minor children want?
Sure. When children are of an age where they can assert their own rights, this is especially true in family courts, but it's no less true in divorce. Children absolutely are understood to have the right to say, I like my mom better. I like my dad better. And even though mom is going for full custody of me, I don't want to never see my dad again, or I don't never want to see my mom again. I want to live with my mom but see my dad twice a week. Or I want to live with my dad, basically. And, I love my mom a lot, but I have always gotten along with my dad better. Again, as a general matter, the courts understand mom and dad each to be coming at this free to assert their full custodial rights. But as a general matter, the interests of all judges are with the children, these things. The children have been brought into a circumstance where mom and dad can't manage to get along with each other. But it becomes especially important for a judge at that point to look to the children to say, you know, I understand that dad is looking for full custody here, but you have a 13-year-old who wants to be with his mom, has always, had his issues addressed by the mom, and even though dad is looking for full custody, this is a 13-year-old who, while happy to see his dad on some schedule, is not looking to end up in the full custody of dad. So, yes, absolutely. The court will absolutely take into consideration what the children's interest. Ultimately, all of this comes at the end down to what the children's best interests are. And especially once you get past the age of, you know, 6 or 7, and then especially up through the teenage years, children's wishes, as best as possible, to the extent that they're reasonable and considered, are going to be understood to have been real responses, even though, you know, they're not, you know, 18 or 21. A 13-year-old can obviously have opinions that they're entitled to, especially when it comes to issues that are specifically personal to them. So, yes, the wishes of the children.
Go ahead.
No, by all means, go ahead.
Okay. Well, yeah, so you were going to say the wishes of the children, assuming you were going to say that the wishes of the children certainly are taken into account. And the sense that I'm getting then is that in family court, in divorce court, there are rules, but it doesn't sound like they're necessarily that hard and fast.
All of this happens with standards that govern and practicalities that rule.
Okay.
And so to some extent, everything that we talk about from the books is kind of a skeleton, a template. And from there, we actually get to how this actually goes down. Is it true that a dad who doesn't get along with his kids and hasn't really been involved in his children's lives during their upbringing can assert, you know, a petition for full custody? Well, of course he can. Is a judge going to honor that? No, of course the judge isn't going to honor that. Judges, as a general matter in family court, are only concerned first and foremost with these kids because the kids are innocent bystanders in this. And especially in instances where people are being unreasonable, right? You know, there's dads who are asserting joint custodial rights because they rightly feel entitled to, and it's reflective of their lifetime involvement in the kids. And there's also dads who are using the kids as a wedge to try either to get the mom to fold earlier than she otherwise would have, or because he doesn't much care whether the mom folds, he just wants to kind of turn the whole thing into a big fat mess because he's resentful of having been drawn into a proceeding where monies that he feels are due and owing to him are being taken away from him. And the judges aren't going to abide by it. The judges aren't going to let a rogue spouse hijack a proceeding and precipitate a result that leads to children being in an environment where they wouldn't rightly be if unbiased eyes were examining it.
Right. And we're going to get into a little bit more about judges' discretion and also party discretion in a divorce situation, because you mentioned mediation, and of course then we're also going to talk about your particular specialty, your practice area, where couples
yes, sure.
can work together so that in the end they can come out with a result that perhaps is more beneficial to the family as a whole and avoids
mm-hmm.
the kind of strategic behavior that you're talking about. But I do want to go back to something here as I'm looking at my notes. I wanted to make sure that we had kind of tied up a question that had sort of come up, And it was a jurisdictional question. We had talked earlier about does she get half, and you know, what is the difference between equitable distribution and community property. So California is a community
mm-hmm.
property state, which is an assumption
mm-hmm.
of 50-50. New York happens mm-hmm. to be an equitable distribution state, which uses different standards. So does it matter where we get married in terms of where these, how these rules apply?
To some extent, the answer has to be yes. You know, I guess people don't really, I don't know that it's going to have any effect on any individual couple's decision of where they get married, but there are, in fact, states, they especially tend to be on the West Coast, but that's not uniformly true, that predetermine everyone's respective rights in property, especially when it comes to marriages, right? So in a state like, for instance, California, California has a set of rules. They're community property rules, and they basically dictate from the get, from the minute you get married, that everything, as a matter of law, that is earned by one or the other spouse during the marriage is understood to be equitably, I shouldn't even use the word equitably here because it's going to confuse the issue, is equally the man and the woman's in the marriage, irrespective of who it was that was out working in the job as compared to, well, working in the job out of the house as compared to working in the job inside the house.
Right, and we sort of addressed that issue. So
mm-hmm.
we sort of addressed that issue. I guess what I'm getting at is this. If I don't like the rules in the state that I'm living in, is there a way
mm-hmm.
that I can use a different set of rules?
Yes, but you need to be very careful about doing them. Ultimately, divorce is governed by state rules, and I don't know what your viewers do and don't know about this, but every state will have slight variations on what is required for you to properly get a divorce in their state. There are certain states that only require you to be living in their state. There's no time limit imposed on you. You simply have to be living in their state. There's also other countries that have rules like this. And once you are understood to be a resident, a domiciliary of their state, you can then go for a divorce in their state without regard to the fact that you were married in another state or that the majority of your marriage happened in another state, specifically
so,
with
one of the things, right, I'm sorry to keep breaking
sorry,
in on
sorry.
You, but
yep.
you're mentioning
all means,
things
all
that I'm like, it's really fascinating. So I could move to another state. I know, for example, I'm going to, you know, out my knowledge about this, but it used to be, for example, that people got what was called a Nevada divorce, right? You could move to Nevada,
yeah.
and by move
yeah.
to Nevada, you could be there for 3 days, be considered a resident
yeah.
of the state, and take advantage of the laws in Nevada.
That's correct. And as far as I know, those laws actually still apply. I'm not a lawyer in Nevada, so I don't practice there.
Right.
But as far as I know, those are still the rules. Yes.
Exactly. You know, and what I've heard lately, I think it's something like now it's 6 weeks. You actually have to be there for 6 weeks in order to qualify as a resident of the state so that you can take advantage of the divorce laws.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that, you know, if I'm understanding correctly, a person can move from one state to another and then follow whatever rules that state has for residency. In a lot of states, it's a year. You have to have been living there for a year. But even
That's
if your
right.
spouse doesn't live there, you can still apply for divorce under the laws of that state.
That's correct. And for your viewers in New York, they should understand that there, and I guess we'll get to that a little later in the show, there was a moment where in New York you could not present to the court a marriage that was simply broken and get a divorce. You would have to allege some set of facts above and beyond the fact that your marriage was merely broken, right? You would have to
What's
allege
after
adultery. In
okay.
this era in New York, the importance of
those grounds has been, I guess it's no longer as important because there is now in all 50 states the ability to simply get a divorce because marriage is broken. Either there's irreconcilable differences or the marriage is irretrievably broken. Different states will phrase the problem in different legal sentences, but they all to some extent arrive at the same issue, which is that the two spouses, through no specific fault of one party at the expense of the other, can no longer stay married, and they are entitled, simply because their marriage is broken, to a divorce. And so, to some extent, the importance of Nevada, or, for instance, the Dominican Republic, there are others, is no longer there because you can get a divorce even in conservatively lawed New York for the reason that your marriage is simply broken. Simply broken.
Okay.
No further fault required.
Right. Well, you brought up a couple of interesting issues there, too. It's really wonderful. Every time you say something, I think of two more questions. But so you brought up the issue that in New York, you know, New York is the last state, as of October of 2010, New York was the last state in the United States to allow for what's called a no-fault or uncontested divorce. Prior to that time, you had to state grounds. And off the top of your head, do you remember what some of those grounds were?
Yeah, they were actually pretty rigorous. In just New York, for instance, would involve an allegation of adultery. But it wasn't simply adultery. It was adultery that was witnessed adultery. Or it would involve cruel and inhuman treatment.
No, let's back up here.
Simply,
what do you mean by witness?
Yeah, sure. When you're trying to allege in New York, if you want to come into a court in New York and allege that you need a divorce because your spouse was cheating on you, it's not simply sufficient for you to go in and say, I think my husband's having an affair, or I think my wife is having an affair. You needed someone to come in and say, I saw this person's spouse having whatever, let's say sex, or having some inappropriate intercourse with another, with a person other than their spouse. So it constitutes adultery. It was
so
very,
you have
very
to
difficult.
Actually provide proof of, well, you have to actually
that's,
provide proof of the deed?
That's correct. And it remains that. It is the rare divorce in this day and age in New York that alleges adultery because you really need to prove it up. But you can continue to move down the line of showings sufficient to get a divorce in New York. And although they're somewhat easier than adultery, they remain rather difficult as a general matter to prove, right? You would have to show, if not adultery, you would have to show cruel and inhuman treatment, right? This wasn't simply a matter of my wife was mean to me. This was a matter of my wife made me feel endangered, or my wife made me feel so belittled that I can't possibly envision myself in a marriage where my wife would make me feel that way. That's cruel and inhuman treatment. You also have abandonment. Abandonment would have to be my husband left the marital home, or my wife refused to have sex with me for a period of time, even though I was, you know, demanding sex from her. It was impossible up until October of 2010 in New York to simply go into a court and say, you know what, the two of us have made a good go of this thing, and it ain't working, and we've tried to write it, and we can't. And want a divorce. And fortunately, the powers that be in New York, following the 49 other states in the nation that had long since come to recognize that couples could just simply not have a good go of things and not have adultery or abandonment or cruel and inhuman treatment be in play, came
well,
to the decision.
Well, maybe not
want
to have to go there.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
It may be that these things are happening in your marriage, but you don't want to have to put that on the record and go through the
whole
process.
That's exactly right.
And all of that kind
of
thing.
Or the convert, to some extent, just to introduce it, the converse, which is that you never had any of it, and
to get a divorce, one or the other of you is going to have to perjure yourself in court to get a divorce, right? That was one of the concerns of the legislators in New York. There were couples who were coming before the courts with lawyers who knew full well and who were honor-bound and duty-bound not to perjure themselves, needless to say, who were coming up with these off-the-wall stories. Let's say in this case it's the husband who's being the accused, and the husband would come into court and say, yeah, it's true. I was, I threatened on any number of occasions to hit my wife, and I, insulted her weight on any number of occasions, which led her to feel belittled in her own eyes. And it was just a lie. It didn't happen. It was just a couple who wasn't doing well, and there were no such happenings in their marriage, but the only way that you could get a judge to sign off on your divorce would be to get a guy to lie in a court of law. And so New York said, no more. No more of this. This is silly. We're implicating, we're involving lawyers in doing this, and we're involving all kinds of people who are admitting ugly things on court records. This is silly, right? It used to be that was how people... it used to be that was what people required to get a divorce, but we're in an era where, it doesn't just take, we're long past the era where, adultery or cruel and inhuman treatment or abandonment are going to be the dictates for the divorce. It can just be that the marriage is irretrievably broken, right? That's who you are. Really, not just not getting along a little, but really, really not getting along, but
okay.
Not treating each other cruelly.
Well, then, go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm done. By all means, by the bill.
All right. there are moments where, again, we're going to work this out with the technology. It will improve. But there are moments where I'm not sure that I can hear you at the end of your sentences. So if that's going on, just go ahead and wait for me to finish what I'm saying, and then you can come back in so that we're not talking over each other, because that's certainly not my intention. But
mm-hmm.
What you are saying right now is a wonderful segue into sort of the next topic that I wanted us to get into. So we now have across the United States no fault or uncontested divorce. We also understand that people can come from different jurisdictions to take advantage of the laws in the various states if they look and they decide, it's not encouraged. It's a thing called
mm-hmm.
forum shopping. And so I don't want anybody
mm-hmm.
listening to think that I or Eric are in any way advocating forum shopping. It's highly frowned upon. But the truth of the matter is that it doesn't matter where you come from, ultimately, if you've established residency according to the rules of the state, even if you're coming from outside of the country and you were married elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
if you were married in England or if you were married in Ghana, it doesn't matter, Japan. If you come to the United
mm-hmm.
States and you're getting divorced, once you have established residency here, the rules that apply to you are the rules of the state that you're in. And so now across the United States, you have no fault or uncontested divorce. And I'm curious about the differences in some of the terminology that I've read. I know some states
mm-hmm.
say irreconcilable differences. Other states say the marriage is irretrievably broken. Is there a difference?
Well, I would say that the answer is yes in the legal sense, but in the practical sense, I would say less so. What they're looking for in any state is that a couple agree that the marriage isn't working. And in different states, the exact phrasing in the legal sense of what the marriage isn't working is slightly different. So, for example, in Georgia, I think there is a requirement that you present to the court showing that there are irreconcilable differences between you. The language in New York is irretrievably broken. It's a period of 6 months that New York now requires for one spouse to allege that the marriage is just irretrievably broken. And with that showing, in any state, you're entitled to what
can most broadly be understood to be a no-fault divorce, right? We were just talking about some of these, you know, very kind of ugly allegations, adultery, cruel and inhuman treatment. Those are all fault-based grounds for divorce, right? Nowadays, in all 50 states, now that New York has
joined the rest
bridge,
of the union.
That's right. Everyone is entitled, be it under a showing of irreconcilable differences or under a standard of irretrievable brokenness or whatever it is that the state requires in that state, that a no-fault divorce, right? You're not alleging adultery. You're not alleging any party to have been more wrong than the other. To some extent, you're coming as a couple here. And I guess we'll get into that, but a lot of the no-fault proceedings kind of still rely on you both to, for one last time, let's say, well, that's not even true either, but for the time being, to kind of get yourselves together, even though you're ready to get a divorce and be separate and apart, that you come together and you say the two of us each agree with each other that this marriage is irretrievably broken. And we need, legally, for a judge to so order our divorce, but I'm not, as the husband, or my wife isn't, as the wife, alleging that she or I was specifically the worse actor in this. In fact, there's no worse actor here, or there's no better actor here. There's just two parties who are in a marriage that is not going to work going forward, and we want out. And to some extent, it ought to be viewed by couples who are contemplating divorce as a real opportunity to keep things on the up and up and to keep, you know, good feelings between the husband and wife and between the husband and the kid and between the wife and the husband's family and any number of different contexts where kind of coming in as a twosome, even though you're not really a partnership, but coming in as a twosome means that you can kind of keep things non-vindictive. You can keep things healthy, although, you know, not functional, but healthy, I guess.
Right.
And it can be a real terrific. I mean, in light of it being kind of a not-so-good circumstance, it can really be made to be a constructive sort of process.
Right.
Where that's how it should be viewed.
Okay. Well, thank you, Eric. We're getting to a point here where we can take a quick break on that note.
Mm-hmm.
We have very nicely set up the next segue.
I intended it to.
Awesome. Which is, we want to talk next about who is a good candidate or what kind of couple is a good candidate for no-fault divorce versus what couple makes a poor candidate for an uncontested or no-fault divorce. And then we're also going to talk about the specific steps that are involved with filing for divorce. So we're going to do that when we come back from this quick break. And I'm going to play another piece for you by a musician whom I adore. This is Valerie June. And the song I'm going to play is called If You Love and Let Go. It's from her album called Valerie June and the Tennessee Express. And she is one of those rare artists who actually sounds better live. I've been to one of her live shows, and I remember thinking to myself, oh, it's just terrible that I can't follow this and take it with me. She's a wonderful performer. So if you ever have a chance to hear Valerie June live, I encourage you to do so. And the style of music is a little bit of a departure from what you've heard on the show, so I hope that you enjoy this and get to know a little bit more about Valerie June and the Tennessee Express, and the song is called If You Love and Let Go. We'll be back in just a moment.
From what I can tell, I'm still under your spell. There's a dream in my eyes, but I'm trying to be wise. I've made mistakes before, used my love as a tool, almost broke. I can't bear to lose you. All my spark me into. I can't bear to lose you. Almost broke me into. Wonder. That I'll leave it behind, but it's fast to return, 'cause my soul longs and yearns to be beside you again. Will you be there, my friend, to have to hold you again? Will you be there, my friend, to have to hold you?
Musician based out in Tennessee, and the song that you just heard was If You Love and Let Go, and it's on her CD called Valerie June and the Tennessee Express. So I want you to look up Valerie June. You don't want to miss out on this up-and-coming artist. She, as I said before, is one of the artists that I find to actually sound better live, and so if you have a chance to hear her, don't miss out on that. So if you're just joining the show, you are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer, a show about social and relationship issues that concern you most. I'm your host, Batabi Limtombini, relationship coach and divorce mediator, and I'm broadcasting live from Harlem, USA. I want to remind you that next Sunday is Mother's Day, and we are going to have a very special show for you next week. And it is a show for you, actually. It's an opportunity for you to call in and tell your mom over the air how much you love her, and you really will be telling the world. I know that there are folks in South Africa who are listening right now, and I've heard from folks in Germany, and because it's on the internet, the show is being broadcasted around the world, so you will have a chance to share your love with your mom. It's also an opportunity for you to share stories about your mom, too, about the special things that she has done for you or she does for you that you remember and that you truly appreciate. So if you would like me to read your tribute over the air, email me at info@123untangled.com. That's info@123untangled.com. Or be prepared to call in next week. The number, again, is 818-532-9789. And for those of you who are listening right now and might have some questions for me and my guest, who is Eric Reimer, a practicing attorney here in New York who focuses on uncontested divorces, if you have a question for us, call into that number, 818-532-9789, and press the number 1. And that will let me know on my switchboard that you have a question. All right. So we're going to come back to Eric and continue our conversation. We were talking specifically about – Hi, how are you doing? We were talking specifically before the break. Good. We were talking before the break about the differences between irreconcilable differences and what it means when a marriage is irretrievably broken and the ins and outs of an uncontested divorce. Now, you have been in practice now for long enough to be able to sort of size up a couple and see whether an uncontested divorce is going to work for them. So what do you look for when you're meeting with a couple to see whether an uncontested divorce will work for them?
Well, I guess the very first showing that you're going to need is a husband and wife who are agreed that their marriage is, in fact, irretrievably broken, right? That's the showing, and that's the baseline showing. But I guess it's important to say that that is although legally correct, practically only the very first stage in figuring out whether you're going to be able to get a judge to order your divorce without paying two different lawyers an awful lot of money to wrangle themselves into a tizzy, cost you a lot of money, and in a place where you may be far more embittered and angry than you were when you first started. A couple who's going to be eligible for an uncontested no-fault divorce is a couple who doesn't merely agree that their marriage is irretrievably broken. They need to have agreed on what to do with all the stuff. They need to know what they're going to be doing with the house, what they're going to be doing with the pension, what they're going to be doing with the bank accounts, with the joint credit cards, with the wife's student loans when she went for her master's degree. Ultimately, when you go to a court and you've been married and you're saying that your marriage is irretrievably broken, the judge is going to say, all right, well, that's nice, but have you figured out how to actually undo this partnership without me intervening? And you can get a sense generally as a lawyer about whether a couple is there because they'll have already had a conversation about, you know, let's take the house, right? The house is going to remain during the minority of the children, and the wife is going to have a possessory interest in the house,
Hold on a second. You just used some interesting language, which I understand, but I'm not sure that everybody else understands. So you just said that during the minority of the children, the wife will continue to have a possessory interest in the house. So for those of us who are not lawyers, what does that mean?
Right, sorry. Well, you know, ultimately the house as a general matter is almost uniformly going to be the biggest asset that a husband and wife have. And ultimately, whether or not to stay or go, and who stays and who goes, and whether to sell the house, and I guess in this day and age, whether the house is underwater, whether the house is worth less than the mortgage due on it. Those are all hugely important issues to have reached terms on between the husband and wife. Oftentimes, a house is owned as marital property, right? You buy it after you got married because you had a new family come in, and there's a house there, and the husband, let's say, agrees that he's going to live same city, but he'll live in a smaller apartment rather than a house, but he still has a house that's deeded in his and his wife's name and a set of kids who are in the school district that was dictated by where the house was purchased. So oftentimes a husband and wife will say, all right, well, you know, husband is going to live in an apartment a couple miles away. Wife will stay in the house, and kids will stay with her. And they come in, and they're saying, well, you know, we don't want the kids to be forced to relocate, but we do probably want to sell that house. So they'll say, we agree that once the kids get through high school, they're either off, you know, in their own jobs or they're off in college, we're going to agree to sell that house and we're going to go 50s on it. We're going to go even Stevens on it, but we're not going to do it until these kids have finished with their schooling, let's say their secondary schooling or their elementary schooling. And so when I say possessory, I mean to say that the wife, in this case, is going to be living in the house, even though the husband has a stake. He still has his name on that deed. He's just not going to be living there. He's not going to be in possession of the house. He's going to be living off in his own apartment.
So he's going to continue to have a legal interest in the house. In other words, if they eventually sell the house, he still has a right to whatever amount of the proceeds that he and his soon-to-be ex-wife decide on. But then she has a right to remain in the house, and that's what you mean by a possessory interest?
That's right. That's right. And then I guess more confounding is the very common nowadays circumstance where the house is worth less than the mortgage. That is an issue that is tripping up judges left and right, because it's always up until 2008 assumed that the house was an asset. And
right.
In the last 2 years, there are any number of people who are coming who are saying this is a house that's unprofitable. It's worth less than the money that we owe on it. And it's very, very difficult to know what to do with those. Typically, to the extent that a short sale can be facilitated, right, there's no kids. If a short sale can be facilitated, you're going to want to get rid of that house altogether and say that the debts accrue equally to the husband and wife. It's an issue that is tripping up judges left and right nowadays. If you find yourself in a circumstance where you're underwater on your house and you're contemplating divorce, you need to see an attorney because it's a difficult issue. Or I shouldn't say it like that. You need to seek counsel. This is not an issue you should be tackling on your own.
Okay, so if you own a house, you're underwater on the mortgage, you're saying don't try to get divorced on your own. Talk to a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would certainly say that.
Okay, well, here's something else that I've heard some couples are doing because they're in that situation where they're underwater, and so selling the house would actually immediately increase their debt load, you know, trying to move out and so forth. People are actually staying in the house together after the divorce.
Mm-hmm.
What is happening in your practice so far as that's concerned?
I have not come across a couple who was amenable to it, but I am aware that it's happening. Again, divorce is a very specific undertaking, and the couple is always going to have a unique issue that they present to a lawyer. If you and your spouse are of the mind that you can get divorced and live comfortably in the same house, you know, one downstairs, one upstairs, whatever the setup is, and you guys are underwater and this is your solution, that's a dynamite solution, but it's not easy to do. Typically, I don't want to step on experiences that you've had, Bobby, but couples who have come to me are not looking, even the ones who are most civil and least vindictive, don't want to be living in the same house with each other. They need separate spaces. So,
I'm actually mediating a divorce right now with a couple who is staying in the house together, and they're doing exactly what you said. One is upstairs and the other is downstairs, and they're going to stay in the house with the kids. And what I'm working out with them is what we call a nesting agreement, where we go through and decide specifically how are they going to use the house as a divorced, living separate lives but living in the same house and still co-parenting mm-hmm. their children. So you're right, it can be done, although it's challenging, and I think it does take changing paradigms a little bit, changing mindsets a little bit. Eric, I'm
Absolutely.
Happy to say we have a call. We have a caller. And so I'm going to come to you. This is somebody in the 526 area code, and I've unmuted your mic. You're on the air, 526 area code. Hello, who is this? You don't have to give your name. You can be anonymous, but please say hello.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Hi, Mark.
I'm doing quite well. How are you?
Good. I think this is an excellent entry point for the prenuptial solution. That, and I should say the personal prenuptial solution, to where these things are dealt with on the front end as opposed to the back end. I understand all the difficulties that you guys are expressing, but
mm-hmm.
that's one of the problems when people just accept the state's prenuptial, because we understand – both you guys are attorneys, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
well,
so you understand there's
I'm
existing prenuptial – when you sign the marriage license.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me?
I want to break in there for a second to both of you,
sure.
the caller, Eric, because I really want people to understand this. If those of you who know me from Facebook will probably have heard me preaching this gospel before. But I think most people don't recognize, you know, they feel very reticent to think about a prenuptial agreement when they're getting ready to get married. It's so unromantic.
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
We're thinking about divorce already. When I point out to them, you really actually do sign a prenuptial agreement when you get married. When you
exactly.
sign that marriage license, if you don't
right.
have a pre-existing prenuptial agreement, you are agreeing to the prenuptial agreement that the state has created for
mm-hmm.
you.
Exactly.
So, caller, if you...
Now, I don't think you attorneys... unnecessarily hiding that from the general public. I think you preferenced it well just a moment ago. The public wants to be ignorant of the reality of what they're doing when they sign the prenuptial. I mean, when they sign the marriage license.
I think you're exactly right, Mike. I certainly wouldn't argue. You certainly won't hear me arguing against people entering prenuptials. The issue is people tend not to enter prenuptials, which leaves lawyers to try, which leaves lawyer to deal with for the first time after the marriage some of these issues that rightly could be done in a prenuptial contract. The other issue is that sometimes it can be, you know, as Bonneville was saying, that this can be perceived by a cheery-eyed couple to be a quite depressing endeavor, right? Here we are, we're standing on the altar, and we're about to get married, and, you know, here's this prenuptial agreement that the two of us have signed, and you certainly won't hear me arguing against them. It's getting people without tainting the relationship to enter them.
Let me just say this, if I may. We don't consider mm-hmm. buying automobile insurance or fire insurance as a means of undercutting our interest. Or in other words,
mm-hmm.
we don't purposely have an accident because we buy auto insurance or burn down
mm-hmm.
our houses because we
mm-hmm.
have fire insurance. It's just in case. But, you know,
mm-hmm.
The public tends to be ignorant about this. Now, a lot of financial planners are suggesting that people do this very thing, craft their own personal prenuptial agreement, and that actually
mm-hmm.
better structures their relationship because it helps them communicate better and maybe makes you guys' job a little bit easier in that divorce is avoided altogether because they've
mm-hmm.
already structured their relationship to be workable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that people just need to be made cognizant of the fact, you know, I was on a program, and it wasn't legal advice, but it was just educational and informational. I was saying, ipso facto, when you sign the state marriage license, you are agreeing to enter into a partnership, which upon
mm-hmm.
divorce is dissolution, and you're pretty much just dividing up the property. So create your own prenuptial, and that will limit the judge's power over your relationship.
Let me just step in here and say that it's not at all to argue with you. It's just to say that when you're entering it, you need to be darn careful that what you're entering is a legal prenuptial agreement. And some of the issues that go into a legal prenuptial agreement are going to be based on contract law, and some of them are going to be based on theories of coercion and duress. A judge is going to be interested not merely in your presenting to him what you understand to be a prenuptial, prenuptial contract. A judge is going to be interested that you've satisfied the legal requirements. It doesn't require you to speak with a lawyer when you draft them, but you do have to be conscious when you're drafting a prenuptial agreement that the prenuptial agreement actually satisfies the legal requirements of any state that you're residing in. And with that, I really am not arguing with you at all, Mike, not at all. Prenuptial agreements are a perfectly functional way of declaring ahead of time what the intentions of the husband and wife are in terms of the marriage. And there's no question that a couple who comes with an existing valid prenuptial contract is an easier divorce to handle than a couple that comes without it.
Okay. Or maybe not having a divorce at all. But I agree with you too, and I think you guys serve a great function. Absolutely, you do. And I say to people to certainly run it by an attorney. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. Have the attorney review your life format, as it were, because mm-hmm. you're laying out your plan for the relationship with this with your significant other. So no, you make a great point, good points. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Good speaking with you.
Right. Great. Thank you so much, caller. Actually, Erica had just asked, "Are you an attorney? You sound so knowledgeable. Are you an attorney as well?"
No, but I work with a lot of them. I work in the legal field, so we're really together on issues. But again, I don't know how you guys can get this out, or even if this is within your jurisdiction. Maybe it's not, mm-hmm. because it would, people having a prenuptial really would, and the Supreme Court decision, I don't know where you guys are, but the famous decision, Marvin versus Marvin, 1976, that makes for fantastic reading. I love reading court decisions, by the way, because they have the essence of life right there. But the Supreme mm-hmm. Court actually told the lower court when they reversed the decision, they said, go seek any written agreement that the couple had. Because, Marvin,
right.
Lee Marvin attempted to say the relationship was purely for sex, which he knew
uh-huh.
that a marriage could not survive on that definition. He knew that. But the thing of
mm-hmm.
it is, the interesting thing is the court basically sanctioned or agreed with a couple drafting their own agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we understand then that couples can draft their agreements. Eric's point is also well taken in that it is useful for the couple to also seek legal advice, at least have somebody look it over to make sure that all of the necessary elements are covered so that when they go to court, if they should need to go to court with their prenuptial agreement, it's all covered. To the caller, thank you so much. Actually, it's wonderful that you brought that up because it is something that I have been trying to get across to people as I talk to with mediation. I should let you know I'm a divorce mediator, so I am not practicing laws in the way that Eric is practicing law. But, of course, we cover the same subject matter, and that is something that I have found that people don't understand, is that when they get married, they really are signing a prenuptial. It's just a state-drafted prenuptial, and
mm-hmm.
they are absolutely free to draft their own prenuptial. So, caller, thank you so very much for calling in, and I hope you continue to listen to the show in the future.
Thank you. I will.
Good. All right, so there is that issue of the prenuptial and what counts as a prenuptial, and then there's also postnuptials. Eric, is that something that you'd feel comfortable getting into?
Sure. I mean, you're ultimately trying to balance here what you can rightly come into as a couple. And I have obviously no problem with couples. I think the more pressing issue is it's hard to get all couples to address these issues up front, along with, I suppose, any number of other issues. But assuming that you're doing valid prenuptial, postnuptial agreements, they're absolutely constructive. I think the limiting issue in all circumstances is getting couples to actually enter into them.
Right. Well, yeah, we keep talking about it, and we'll keep plugging away at it. And, it used to be, in the beginning when life insurance was introduced to the general public, my understanding is that people were horrified about the idea of putting money on a person's life, and that it took some time for conventional wisdom to catch up to the idea that you're actually protecting your family by purchasing life insurance. And I think that perhaps there's a similar opportunity where prenuptial agreements and postnuptial agreements are concerned. And, of course, a postnuptial agreement simply means that a couple enters into agreement after they've been married. And it might be something they want to look into in terms of updating a prenuptial if they have one. But, some common myths are that prenuptials are for wealthy people. That's not true. And that prenuptials are, unromantic and cause people to eventually get divorced. And that's not true either,
right.
But it does certainly help for couples to go into the marriage with a clear and common understanding of their expectations during the marriage and their expectations of what might happen if the marriage should end. So there are a lot of things that speak for having a prenuptial agreement. But again, I thank the caller for bringing that up, and Eric, for your very helpful comments as far as that is concerned too. So we were talking then about who is a good candidate for no fault and who's a poor candidate for no fault or for uncontested divorce. And to sort of summarize, what I heard you saying is that when there is a couple that both agree that they want to get divorced, they agree about how to distribute their assets or how to divvy up their assets, they agree about children if they have children, where the children are going to live, how visitation is going to happen, how they're going to share in parenting and supporting their children and each other. Those are couples, you're saying, who can go for an uncontested divorce, right?
Certainly. And just to back off, of it a little, it can also include couples who are not quite there, but are between the two of them amenable with guidance to reaching a point where they are there, right? So I have couples who come into me and they say, we already know what we're going to be doing in terms of custody and visitation. We figured out how much child support we owe each other. We figured out whether, any alimony is due between the two of us. I also have couples who come in and they say, you know what, the two of us are ready to get a divorce, and we want to do it on grounds that are kind of not really vindictive, and we generally know how we want to proceed, but we don't have any legal framework with which to approach it. And that's a good moment to involve an attorney in getting you a no-fault divorce. No-fault divorce, as a general matter, is going to be substantially cheaper than a divorce where the grounds are where you're coming in as a contested couple, right? You don't have to go to court. You don't have to hire.
So let's talk actual numbers there for a second, because what you're starting to say there is one of the advantages is that you don't necessarily have to hire and pay for two separate lawyers.
I mean, just for I run a website, getanewyorkdivorce.com. We are an uncontested divorce website. I also do, obviously, contested divorce work and other general practice work out of my regular practice, the Reimer Law Firm. GetANewYorkDivorce.com can handle a divorce for you from anywhere from $500 to $1,000. When you are talking about coming into a court with two lawyers and contesting and fighting each other tooth and nail, I mean, to some extent, the sky's the limit, but on a very real intangible basis, you're talking about a $10,000 or $20,000 endeavor, right? At the very least, if the two of you are going to come in fighting each other on every little point, you're going to hit $10,000-$20,000 in legal bills so quickly you won't even know what happened to your marital estate by the time the whole thing is said and done.
Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely. I mean, when it's not even contingent on the holdings of the couple, right? There's any number of lawyers who are out there who are more than happy to let you part with all of your assets, even if all of your assets are $10,000-$20,000, right? You have more assets, when you have more fight left in you, you can hit $100,000. I mean, there are certainly divorces out there that are racking up legal bills in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, that's
right.
Not common.
And you know what? I'm going to cite a statistic actually that I also tend to cite as often as possible. There is a report from Consumer Reports that estimates that the average contested divorce costs between $40,000 and $180,000.
Is that right? That's the average? That
average.
Shocks me, but okay.
Average.
There you go.
Contested
there
divorce between $40,000 and $180,000. And you're talking about doing it perhaps for $1,000. I mean, if the couple can come in and agree to things, imagine what they can do with the $39,000 that they have left.
That's right. No
right.
question. And it's a whole state of mind. You know, there's something empowering to even a divorced couple to know that they managed to run thread this needle in a way that saved them. You know, I'm actually shocked to hear those statistics. I would have guessed they were substantially lower, but $40,000 to $180,000, it's just inconceivable.
Well, here's what happens. Right. Well, here's what happens, Eric, is that most people, you know, they look with incredulity and shock when I cite these numbers, and then I remind them that length of time matters, because in a contested divorce, you're also talking about incurring these costs over a matter of years. So we're talking 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years.
That's correct. It doesn't all
happen all at once necessarily. It can happen really quickly, but a contested divorce can take ages. When it comes to an uncontested divorce, I know for myself in my mediation practice, the average time is 8 sessions. I will spend 8 sessions with a couple, and each session is just about an hour or perhaps an hour and a half. So in 8 to 12 hours, I can work with a couple to come up with an agreement to dissolve their marriage. You're talking, on the other hand, about people taking 3 to 5 to 7 years. In your practice,
right.
What is the average time when people come in and
That's right. You know, ultimately, the biggest – I like to joke that the biggest hang-up in the time that it takes for you to get your divorce is whether the clerk puts your divorce packet on the top or the bottom of the judge's pile. Because insofar as you and me and you, the client, are concerned – You and I can get your divorce papers turned around in a week or two or three or four, depending on whether you have kids in the house. It ultimately is going to come down to whether you spend a month waiting if your packet is on the top of the judge's pile, or 2 or 3 months waiting if your packet is on the bottom of the judge's pile. Outside of that, you can have a divorce if you're coming in uncontested in a mere short 2 months, 3 months, right? Instead of dragging it out for years and years, hating each other ever more, poisoning your relationship with your children, spending the entire marital estate, helping lawyers go on vacations that they rightly don't deserve, blah blah blah. I shouldn't say it laughingly. It is a real issue. Lawyers are more than happy to let you part with your money if you let us. More than happy.
Exactly. Think about it this way. When you're fighting your spouse, you're actually paying for your lawyer's children's orthodontia.
That's exactly right.
That's what it is. All right, listen, Eric, I do contest the divorce.
I'm a practitioner who operates on the up and up, but I make an awful lot more money on the contested divorces than on the uncontested divorces.
Right. Yeah. Interestingly, perverse incentives that are involved in that particular situation. Eric, we're going to take a bit of a break here, and then when we come back, we're going to finish up. We have just about 20 minutes left in the show. once we come back from this break. And so we're going to use that time to tie up any loose ends and to take any last-minute calls that folks have. So while we're on the break, you can be thinking about your question. The call-in number is 818-532-9789, and press the number 1 if you want to be put on the air. We're going to hear now from Loida, and this is an artist that you have heard before, and I've told you, if you're a regular listener to the show, that she's especially special to me. This is somebody I grew up with, and I turned around one day and was shocked to find that she's actually really good as a singer, and so she recently recorded an album. It's called Live at Bohemian Caverns. The song is called I'm Still Here. Enjoy, and we'll be back in just a moment. I'm your host, and you are listening to Untangled Resolutions' presentation of The Problem is the Answer. And right at this moment, I am broadcasting live from Harlem, USA. This is a show about the social and relationship issues that concern you most, and today we are talking about divorce. Before we get back to the show, though, I want to remind you that Sunday, this coming Sunday, May 8th, is Mother's Day. And so I would love to have you join on the show and take advantage of a special opportunity to call and tell your mother over the phone, over the internet, but you'll be calling on the phone, how much you love her and why she's so special to you, and to share with the world, really, what makes your mom so special. So be ready to call in next week. Also, if you'd like me to read a tribute to your mom, perhaps share a story about her over the air, you can call or email me at info@123untangled.com. That's info@123untangled.com. I'm on the show today with Eric Reimer, who is an attorney and who specializes in divorce and in uncontested divorces. Eric, you are back on the air.
Hey, love you.
Good. Hi. Okay, great. Listen, you mentioned your website very briefly right before the break, and I would like you to go ahead and mention that information again, if you would.
Sure. I have a website that works uncontested no-fault divorces. It's available at getanewyorkdivorce.com, getanewyorkdivorce.com. I'm an attorney practitioner out of New York. I'm based out of Westchester, and I am also admitted in New Jersey. So I handle contested and uncontested divorce work and family law work in the New York metropolitan area. You can reach me at 646-596-4394, 646-596-4394, and it's been great being with
you.
Wonderful. Happy to continue, continue this interview here.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I want you to know that that information has been put up in the chat room. Your website information has been put up there, and it's also now recorded. So anybody who is listening to this show on demand can also have that information. So if you're in the New York area or in New Jersey and you're interested in talking with Eric about your own situation, you certainly are welcome to do that. All right. So we're going to go back to the show and talk about wrapping things up here in the last part of the show. We talked about a number of things, and I want to make sure that folks have a sort of organized idea of what happens when people file for divorce. My understanding is that there are something like three major areas that the court is going to want to be sure that a couple has made decisions about, especially if they have children. And talk with me a bit about the areas that the court is going to be interested in.
Sure. Well, I guess the court, first and foremost, when you have kids, is going to be interested in determining visitation and custody. All right. So in terms of visitation, the visitation schedule is to say how is mom going to see the kids? How is dad going to see the kids? It's to say, how is dad going to access the medical records? How is mom going to know to go to parent-teacher conferences if the kids are staying with dad? Custody. Custody is ultimately an issue that needs to be resolved for the court. It can come down to sole custody. It can come down to joint custody, and it can come down to split custody. These are all legal definitions that you should more properly perhaps undertake with a lawyer in your state and specific to your inquiries. But it's going to turn on whether mom or dad or both is going to be understood legally to be the custodian of the children. And it can have both important legal and psychological implications for a divorcing couple, right? Dad may not want to say that mom is sole custodian, even though he is amenable to divorce. Or mom may say, I don't want this guy involved in my kids' lives anymore. I want to be sole custodian. I don't want to be still attached to my ex-husband through my children over this. So that's one big inquiry. The next big inquiry is going to be.
Let me step in here for a second. So you're talking about a situation where a couple now has to hash through the nitty-gritty. of making a decision mm-hmm. here. And I do want to talk with folks about how it is that people in a practice like mine can actually be collaborating with people in a practice like yours, Eric, where your main focus when you're doing uncontested divorces is making sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed and that the couple has understood all of the legal implications of what they're doing. But when it comes down to actually discussing these issues, they can actually work with a mediator, which is what I do, to sit
Absolutely.
Down and talk with them about why it's important that the decision go one way or the other, to sit and talk with them about the realities of things. One of the things that we do is reality testing, where we'll come up with a variety mm-hmm. of schedules and say, really, what actually works for you in this situation? And we can also take into account the wishes of the children if they are old enough to be able to mm-hmm. Really have a say in what's going on. So this is an opportunity for folks to use a couple of practitioners in order to come to a decision that really does meet the best needs of the family, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, just the same way that I wouldn't have, that I didn't intend to fight Mike on prenuptials and entering them without, entering them with only the assistance of a lawyer, same deal. The mediators and all other kinds of people who can interface in producing a productive divorce, you're not going to hear me saying nothing negative about any of them at all. There's absolutely a place for all kinds of different actors in this, especially when the husband and wife are, I don't want to use the word mature, but substitute a non-pejorative word for mature enough to figure out a way to get a divorce without poisoning their relationship and the relationship of them with their children. No question.
Right. Exactly. So we were talking then about working out the issues of visitation. I actually prefer the term parenting. And in the mediation mm-hmm. world, we use the term parenting and parenting plans, and I think it's becoming
yep.
more ubiquitous of a term. But, you mm-hmm. know, that has to do with how are the parents going to remain active in the lives of their children. But then there's also the issue of child support. And if we could really
mm-hmm.
quickly talk a bit about how child support is determined,
yeah.
what happens from state to state or in New York? Is it the same across the country? How does that work?
That's right. No, unfortunately, child support is going to be a state-by-state inquiry. In the state in which you're divorced, the laws will govern who pays child support and when and how much. In New York, there are specific guidelines. They're mandated by the state, and they turn on, first of all, how many children you have and then how much money husband and wife make separately and together. As a general matter, when you have one child, you're looking at paying 19%. And when 17%, excuse me. And when you have two children, 21, and then 25%. Let me start that over. Hold on 1 second. 17, 21, 25. My goodness gracious. As a general, let's do that one more time. You're typically looking when you have one child paying 17%, and then am I doing those right, Bonabiel? Now you got me doubting myself here.
Yeah,
and then,
17% for one child. I'm flipping through. As a matter of fact, it's funny because I have my child support guidelines here.
Guidelines
in front
there?
Of me. But the point of the matter is that so if it's for one child it's 17%, for two children it's 25%, for three children it's 29%, for four children 31%, five or more
31
children
31 and then 35%.
When you come into five or more children, come on, y'all.
That's right. Exactly.
But,
so you should be aware that even with only one child, you're looking at having an obligation imposed on you by the state of something like a fifth of your income. And the closer you get to having five children, the state is going to say, as a general matter, that one-third of your income is understood to be dedicated to your children, and that is until the children reach the age of 21 years old or emancipation or, depending on whether they are college-bound children, it can even extend beyond 21 years old.
Okay,
and
I
that is
make
a
sure
mandatory.
People understand this. I'm going to hold on. I'm going to jump in here for a second. Understand this, because I thought this was really interesting that the state of New York does this. You become an adult in the state of New York at the age of 18. But for the purposes of child support, your parents are obligated to pay child support until you're 21.
That's right.
So you can move out of the house at 18. You can make your own decisions, decide what you're going to do. But they're obligated to pay child support until you're 21. And then if you're going to college, they are obligated to keep supporting you beyond that in certain aspects as well, right?
It certainly can be, yeah. It absolutely
now,
can be.
Well, here's something that I want people to know about, though, as well. So I put out these numbers, and generally speaking, you know, they're like a stake through the heart to most people, because that kind of number is like, whoa, whoa. The truth of the matter, though, is, Eric, are people necessarily hard and fast bound to those numbers?
No. No, and it is another moment for everyone to step back and consider what it is that they intend to do with this divorce. Between the two of you, between you, wife, and your husband, the two of you can agree to terms that set those numbers at a weekly or monthly rate that's going to be productive, both in terms of supporting the children and in terms of permitting both husband and wife to account for their own needs. When you manage to settle a divorce between the two of you outside of the courts, you can say, well, yes, understood, we got two kids. So as a general matter, you know, we're on the hook for about a fifth of our cash. But, hey, you know, Dad is going to be having custody of these kids 3 days a week. He's going to be taking care of them, and there's undoubtedly going to be expenditures that he makes during the time in which he's in custody of, and, you know, in parenting of the children that will be understood to have been contributory toward child support. And so between husband and wife, we agree that husband, even though he's the primary breadwinner, is only going to be due to pay 10% above and beyond the monies that he expends on behalf of the kids when they're in his custody. Those can be waived. Those child support guidelines can be waived between the husband and wife. But it has to be
if they decide to get together.
An agreement. You have to agree to that.
Exactly.
That's right.
There is a model that is available, really, that parents can use. I know that one of the great cries that I hear from usually dads, because, you know, we're talking about a stereotypical arrangement here, is that, you know, I'm paying my ex-wife child support, so it's like I'm putting money into her pocket. I have no idea how she's spending the money, and so it can cause an awful lot of resentment on the part of men generally, who tend to be the ones from whom the money is going. And so there's a model that allows parents to set up a bank account that is for the children, and rather than thinking about it as one parent paying child support to another parent, they are now contributing to the children's budget. And so they can deposit the money into that account. They can have two debit cards on the account. Both of them are entitled to get statements from the account, and they make a promise to each other that they're only going to use the funds in that account for the children's expenses. So, you know, that's one way of dealing with a situation where you've got a lot of resentment getting built up from one or the other parent because they feel as though they're continuing to have to pay this person whom they got a divorce from because they couldn't get along in the first place.
That's right. No question.
Okay.
It also facilitates situations where one spouse is being prevented from seeing the children by the other spouse, but I guess that may not be an issue to endeavor on right now with 5 minutes left.
By all means, contact
a lawyer or mediator if you find yourself in that circumstance.
Yeah. So we have about a minute left between you and I, because I have a couple of pieces of business to do in wrapping up in the last few minutes. I just want to make sure that folks understand and that the major areas that a person will cover when they're doing a divorce, whether it's contested or uncontested, is the division of assets, first of all, and then the child support if there are children, and then there's the issue of maintenance. And we haven't had a chance, maybe I'm going to have you come back and talk about the details that are involved in how they determine how much maintenance for how long. We touched upon it very briefly at the beginning of the show, the idea that it's no longer assumed that there's going to be maintenance for the rest of the person's life, and usually with the woman, but there's an understanding that eventually she'll be able to support herself. And then when it comes to division of assets, at some point it would be great if you could come back and we can talk about what count as assets. You mentioned pension a couple of times, right? And so I think most people don't understand that their retirement account is considered marital property. And so when you get divorced, your spouse is actually entitled to a portion of your pension that was accrued during the life of the marriage. So we will certainly talk about having you come back on the show. Eric, thank you so much. You've been a wonderful
guest. My pleasure, Bobby. Good speaking with you. Oh, thank you very much.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Eric Reimer, who is a practicing attorney in the state of New York. His area of specialty is divorce, and specifically he also does uncontested divorces, and so we've been talking about what happens in the divorce context. Please be sure to tune in next week. We'll be talking about a much happier topic. We will be celebrating Mother's. So look out for information about that. You've been hearing the announcements during the show. And I will leave you now with another song from Cuckoo. And quite appropriately, the song is called She Said I'm Done. It's from his album, Unexpected Pleasures. And have a wonderful week, everybody. It was great spending some time with you, and I hope to join you, or hope you join me, again next week.
I'm done.